Hi, welcome back to the Ryle Books podcast. For this episode, we're sharing with you the recording of the launch of How to Leave the World by Marouin Bakhti, which was translated from the French by Laura Vergenon and published by Divided in 2024. The launch took place at our space in Brussels on the 30th of November last year. Everyone is asking about his identity: gay, Muslim, French, Moroccan. Instead of choosing a side, he writes a book. A book about the forest and the city, Paris and Tangier, shame and forgiveness, dating apps and spiritual discovery. A book about growing up as a diaspora kid in rural France, with desires that want to emerge at any cost. Told in mesmerizing prose, How to Leave the World is a beautiful non-answer. Marouin Bakhti is a writer and arts journalist. Born in Nantes, France, to a Moroccan father and a French mother, he studied history and journalism at the Sorbonne. He writes criticism for Mouvement magazine and lives in Paris. How to Leave the World is his first novel. Marouin's reading is followed by a conversation with Oscar Mathieu, who is a cultural worker based in Brussels. He performs, writes, draws, translates, tattoos, and researches. His focal points of interest include self-organization, faggotry, and dogs. We hope you enjoy the recording.
Well, okay, so we start then. Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here for this discussion around how to leave the world. We are in Ryle, my favorite bookshop in Brussels. This is Marouin. Marouin is a writer and journalist, born in Nantes, is that it? Yeah, from a French mother and a Moroccan father. He lives in Paris. He works as a journalist in the magazine Mouvement. And How to Leave the World is his first novel. I am Oscar. I am an artist, I write and I translate, and the reason I'm here today is because I was doing, last year I was doing an internship at Divided Publishing, the publishing house that ended publishing this book, and one of my mission as an intern was to find French books that I thought would be nice for Divided to publish in English, and I stumbled upon Comment sortir du monde, the original version of the book. And I told Divided, you have to translate it and you have to publish it because it's amazing. And so yeah, we're gonna, I don't know, are there people here who have read the book already? Yes? Congrats. For the other, you can buy it at the end. Yes, I guess we're going to start by a reading by Marouin.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for coming. So I'm going to write a part that is at the end of the book. I think the book is much more dark in general, but I don't know. I thought we need a bit of light tonight, so I choose a moment where the narrator is in love and things are getting better with his family, so just thought that I don't know, it will help us all to spend a good night. Essays. Lots of times, it's when we speak without thinking that ideas come to us, that things happen. I respond, sometimes the truth is better left unsaid. We were brought up so differently. S also says, you should tell your father about your life. Tell him about me. I respond, sometimes the truth is better left unsaid. Our realities are on opposite ends of the spectrum. It's true though, I admit. My father no longer seems to be fanning the flames that once incinerated in my poetry and my secrets. A large drawbridge has lowered between us, and we look at each other with new curiosity. On the patio, in the approaching spring, everyone's sharing anecdotes, things they saw or heard somewhere. I listen and tell myself that the time for secrets has passed. And yet, with self-awareness comes the realization that you never really wanted to know who you were at the edge of that brambly terrain. It comes with the understanding that you were always trying to escape the insipid warmth of blue ties. All that lost time to make up for. I think that for him it's normal. The distance from me. The money he sends me. The rare, cautious questions. One morning, we all pick blackberries together at the back of the garden, along a wall blackened by rain. Of course, I stain my t-shirt. Then we go inside and my mother rinses the berries, thoroughly in the sink. My father is lavishing laughter on my sister and brother, seated around the dining table. I watch them. I smile. I say nothing. The patio doors are open to the blooming garden, illuminating the three of them. It's a beautiful scene that smells of sugar. My mother boils the blackberries. "Let's make jam," she explains. They are talking about anything, about nothing. It's pleasant. My father looks at me, interested in my opinion. This is the denouement. We pour sugar in a smudge, scalding fruit. We take turns mixing, pretending it's a contest. Time to seal the jars. Everyone scatters, somewhere in the house or garden, while the fruit mixture rests. Calm returns. S often says, "The silence in your family is not about reserve. It's about taboo." And I say, "You have no idea what you're talking about. Sometimes the truth is better left unsaid." My adult body in the doorway, eyes up and filled with the beautiful things I've seen, and them, stunned to silence, happy in a way that I'm back. My visits bear fruit. The weather gets better, the sky clears, and I have my golden chamsa in the hollow of my clavicles, and now I move through the world certain of loving thick hands and knotty tights. I come from a nameless tribe, j'ai dit left without telling us. My golden chamsa nestles in the hollow of my clavicles. From no one, nothing affects me. I move through the world, sure that I love brown hair caresses and smiling moustache. I exist certain of that I'm the son of Muhammad, himself the son of Muhammad, himself Uld Ali. Revealed scraps and eternal secrets act as a fermenting agent. I come to terms with myself. I'm not the only one shifting through the stories of a chaotic legacy. Diaspora kids are so cringe, says a friend. But then there is that incredible faculty given us to step outside of our culture and take root elsewhere, otherwise, however we like. I tell myself that the diaspora is like a great folk of chimeras. People who have kids and teach them you can never go home again. And those same people who have other kids and tell them, "I don't know who we are. Figure it out. Invent something." A whole horizon of possibilities. Our embarrassed parents watching on and people back home smiling at our awkward gestures and mispronounced words. So yes, we have to collectively endure the weight of an entire country bearing down on us. But isn't that the beauty of it? We sprout across France regardless. We invent ways to show our nativeness and that we are the future, both at the same time. Midday slump and orja syrup, ice cubes in the coffee. I'm mainly thinking about his mouth biting my neck, still warm from the sun. The iodine remains in S air all day and night. In the dark, it clings to my chest, his legs braided with mine. In my head, I tell him, "I want to give you a child. I want us to scandalize the world with a hyper-innovative technique that will allow our bodies unprecedented feats. you will conceive from a blend of our ejaculations. Something will grow in your belly, nature obliging, and you will bring a baby into the world for the two of us. I'm so filled with longing for you that I could steal a kid off the street and say it's ours. He tells me in a bedroom with the lights off, I don't ever want to get married. But I don't care about the dress, or the suit, or the detached house, or the sea. Could not care less. I want to plant my seed filled with love in your body, unable to receive it. And for a miracle to make it work. Raising a child doesn't interest me, just to be clear. It's simply for the beauty of the act. He whispers, one day I'd like to be a dad. Come on then, let's merge to create a perfect offspring inside your belly. I want to deform your skin and bring forth a little person with both our faces. To hell with the skeptics. I want a scientific revolution. You will give me a sublime child. In a paradise of my dreams, I see crevasses filled with desire and roots that plunge into a pond of joy. Loving is long. It's like opening the magic silver shell of an oyster. A dagger in my purple heart, brimming with hope. The closeness between S and me is like cement poured into a mold of our fears. The ingredients? My dead anxiety and a juvenile faith. Our language is like elvish chants or recitation from the Quran, incredible to someone who doesn't believe in magic. I feel safe, I smell him everywhere I go. In the soil and on a crust of bread, in the wool of a scratchy blanket and in the middle of a sodden street. Suddenly, jealousy from the depths. It's never come to the surface before. He reveals, an ex-lover gave me that plant. He repeats himself, tells me a few times, and always enthusiastically. I know the story by heart. After they had sex, the guy gave him a shoot, S took it home, planted in a pot, and now here it is, growing in his windowsill. One day, S is in the shower and I look at the plant. I grab a leaf and tear it off, then crush it in my palm. Relief. I decide to go for it. I pour a handful of salt in the potting soil around the plant. I take the jug of water from the coffee table and empty it into the pot. And I put a smile back on my face and sit on a small velvet couch, calmly waiting for S to finish. During conversation a few days later, he whispers, you never get jealous, it's annoying. Behind him, I see the brown leaves starting to fall. I smile, teeth clenched. Thank you.
Thank you for this beautiful reading. I realized before that I didn't really introduce the book, so I'm just gonna read the back cover for those who haven't done that yet. Everyone is asking about his identity. Gay, Muslim, French, Moroccan. Instead of choosing a side, he writes a book. A book about the forest and the city, Paris and Tangier, shame and forgiveness, dating apps and spiritual discovery. A book about growing up as a diaspora kid in rural France with desires that want to emerge at any cost. Told in mesmerizing prose, how to leave the world is a beautiful non-answer. And I think it's kind of amazing because the part that you read has all these elements in it, even though like it's not like a it's very partial in the sense that there is a lot of other things happening in the book. But yeah, it's already very there. So yeah, I would like to ask first, like, what is the impulsion that you that makes you write a book and this book in particular?
So it's a very fragmented book in terms of form. And so for me, writing is like that. I cannot write for hours, just like back and forth and back and forth. So I would say that you can still fit it in the book now. And at first I was just, you know, writing as, I don't know, something. As far as I can remember, I was always writing. So I don't really want to understand where it comes from. It's just there, I think. But yeah, the book was this enormous mass of fragments, you know. And I met my now friend, Mehdi, that is also my publisher in France. And he read all of those fragments and he told me, okay, there is a book. And of course, I was avoiding this because, you know, publishing is also being read and it's something that you, I mean, it's like, it's kind of terrifying when it's not, that has not happened to you yet. So I was like, okay, you think there is a book? I don't think so. And so we kind of fought for months like that. And at some point I was like, okay, let's try to create something that looks like a book. So I just, I don't know, I was lying to him, you know, I was just saying like, like, yeah, I'm working and it's going very well. And I was doing nothing, vegetating at home. I mean, just reading those fragments and I could not see, you know, any like, I will not say I try to write books, you know, with a beginning and an end and something very like a classical narrative, but at least you have to, you know, hold the hand of the reader. You cannot be lost in your book. I mean, not totally lost, I would say. So I just printed all of those fragments and just, you know, spread it out on the floor of my flat. And I just look at it for hours. And then I realized the skeleton of the book, those movements actually, back and forth, as I said, it's a method, but it's also the life of the character who is trying to, you know, escape his family, but he's also trying to kind of like reconciliate with them, understand where he comes from, you know, those things we all go through in a way. And so those trajet? Trajectory.
Mind blank. Thank you.
Yeah, so he was visiting and then escaping and then visiting. And I don't know, I thought this dynamic could be something. And I also, of course, saw the two deaths that happens in the book. And I thought I could use that as, yeah, a skeleton of the book. So I just tried to organize all those fragments. But at the end, this book is just like a big collage, I would say, of things I just write.
Okay.
Also, it's just, as the second book, I think, and maybe all of the others, maybe, if I'm happy, I mean, lucky enough, and happy. those books are just emerge, you know, objects of what I do every day, and what I do every day is just writing. It's just, you know, the process, and I don't really see them as, you know, enclosed objects. Yeah, that's okay. how it happens.
Okay. Earlier, we talked a bit about the spiritual nature of writing for you. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, it's absolutely, I mean, it's very interesting because the book, so now it's translated in English. And when I went to London for the launch, I met some, you know, readers, and they were, of course, talking about the spiritual trajectory of the narrator. And how faith was really helpful for him at some point in the book. And I realized then that in France, when the book was out in, I mean, almost 2 years ago, no one really talked about that. Like it was something that, like, because it's Islam, you know? Yeah. So everyone is so awkward with this question. I mean, in the press, I would say, at least. So it was like something that no one really addressed directly. Which is weird because I think for the character it's really important, but also for me. And I will be so happy at the time to speak about that. So I don't know, but it always been kind of, okay, I don't want to sound too mystic, but I think it's, I don't know, I think it's just coming from somewhere up there. And me, the only work, my only job is to be there at the right moment, I would say, you know. So you can spend hours doing nothing, you can be alone in your apartment, you know, going out, going in, trying to... But yeah, you have to. I don't have any method other than just trying to be there at the right moment, you know. So it's a lot of being patient, but it's also very spiritual. And I would say also, the first time I discovered poetry was reading the Quran. So it's just very connected to that for me. Yeah, it's divine in that way.
I think you have the right to be a mystic. It's your own book, so you can be whatever you want.
Yeah.
Yeah, about seeing your book being translated, I was wondering, like, first, how does it make you feel? That's because I feel like it's a step. It's a big step. It's quite nice. And also, like, what was your involvement in the process of the translation?
So when Divided wrote to us, I was so relieved, like really relieved. Like I was so happy that, you know, the book could escape this dichotomy, the like Arabic and French, the two languages that I fought with for my entire life, you know? So I was so happy that, you know, this story can be read in another language. That was my first impression. I was just relieved. Because like this Arabic I can't speak, you know, and this French that is such like a rigid and like a very rigid language. Yeah. So that I think it's a really good thing. But also, and in the same kind of way of thinking about it, you just don't cling to your book. I think it's not helpful to do that. So we just tried to find the best person to translate it, which was La Vergniaud. I mean, she did a very great job, I think. And I just gave her the book. And I was like, okay, now you just... I see her work as something... I mean, you can't translate poetry. I don't think it's possible. I think she's just suggesting here an interpretation of what I wrote in French. And I think it's interesting in itself. It's like... it's another thing now. Mm. So, but I was not really involved in the translation process. I mean, she was writing me emails, but I was always kind of like saying, yeah, do it. Do it as you think it's the better. I mean, yeah. And sometimes, but I can say that it kind of made me understand things about my own practice of poetry. Sometimes she was asking me, what do you mean by that? And I was like, I don't know. I was like reading me and I was like, that's not me. But that's also the point. And it's connected to what I said before. It's not me, you know? Mm. You know, so sometimes I write for like a week and then I read everything I write. And I was like, and the parts I discover, because sometimes I discover things. I'm like, I didn't write this, you know? Like, this is not me. And I think those are the best parts because it's just... happening, you know. You have to escape from yourself. You have to put distance. But yeah, so it's also like the questions that La Vergniaud was sending me were always kind of also disturbing for me. So I remember she asked me about Lumière Verte. So the character is just walking by the Seine in Paris, wandering around, kind of like a mess. And the sentence is just like green light, comma, I don't know, walking around. I don't know. I don't remember. And she said, what do you mean by that? Because the lights are not green. And I was just, I didn't know what to answer at the time. I don't remember. And now, I don't know, I think, like, it's the color of nightmares, maybe, you know? But you're just trying to, like, reanalyze what you just wrote, and you learn things about yourself, about how you see life, about, you know? So I was just, yeah. And then I realized that, and I was thinking about my nightmares, and I was just going deeper and deeper, which is, I don't know, like, always a good thing to do, you know?
Yeah. And you had an interview with a conversation with Lara Vogneau that is published online. Don't know where exactly, but I read it. And so in it, you mentioned the impossibility of translating to Arabic this book. And I was wondering if you want to explain why.
No, I don't know if it's impossible to translate that book specifically in Arabic, but what I know is that for me, at least, it's impossible to imagine that, you know, to project that kind of thing. Also because Arabic doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
So you have to, like, it's just a continuum of dialects that you speak all over the Arab world. So you translating that book into Arabic, you already have to choose, like, kind of, now the dialect, because you have, like, uniformized way of talking, but I mean, yeah. So it will be very weird to do that. Also, I mean, weird to me in terms of, you know, translations. And I don't know, this would mean that I'm going to be perceived, you know, in some parts of the world, which is actually Morocco. And I don't know yet if I'm ready for that. It's also kind of like, yeah, not really comfortable for me now. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just, I don't know. Maybe it will happen, you know? And that will be an amazing thing. But it's going to be much more different than, you know, translating in English, I think.
Yeah.
And also the, you know, the economy of Arabic books are very different from, I mean, it's kind of, yeah, difficult, but I don't know, still in process, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering also on the subject of translation, if you like seeing the reception of the book. The book has had a super good reception in France when it came out, right? It's quite of the same now, so it's a big success. But I was wondering, like, apart from this, like, not wanting to ask about spirituality, like this reticence to do that in the French climate, did you notice like a difference in the reception of the book between the French public and the English speaking public?
Except from that Muslim thing, that is a big thing, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't realize that kind of thing, actually.
No. Okay.
Not really, like, it's... Not, yeah, not yet. I will not say that.
Yeah, no. It was already a big thing.
It's actually a big thing. You know, like... I think they are much more, like, in the UK at least, they are much more direct on that specific question of faith. You know, it's not... it's my feeling from where I am. So it's, as a French, just feel that it's less of a taboo, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe less of an obsession. Maybe not less of an obsession, but of a taboo, I would say. So... That's how I felt, you know, and people were much more open to discuss that and much more interested also, which means something. We talk about that.
Yeah.
Also, in France, this didn't happen. And now that it's been months, I can realize also it was helpful in a way because, you know, it didn't really put me in a place where, I don't know, far right will identify me as, you know, a target. So it's kind of also... maybe, I don't know, something that people thought was well-intentioned, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of sad that we can address, face as a beautiful thing. You know?
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like, so you touch on many subjects that can be seen as, I mean, the way you write about this book, it can be seen as an act of activism, because you write about this subject, this identity subject.
Identities.
Yeah.
That's what you mean, yeah.
Identitaire, I wanted to say the adjective, yeah, okay. But I don't know how to say that in English. So you talk about identity, about Islam, about homosexuality, etc. But was it perceived by the public as something that can be linked to to activism because it's very personal and because it's political because everything is. I was wondering if the reception was like in that sense, like if you had comments and
Of course it was received as such sometimes, but I mean, people connected, of course, with their personal experiences, which is the point of writing a book, I would say. So that was pretty enriching. I mean, joyful. But about that activism thing, I just think we are doing, I mean, it's literature, so it's not activism. We have kind of the same, I'd of course agree with, align with the, I don't know, and anti-racist feminism and, you know, that. But also it's not, I think it's just not my job. Like, there is activism and there is literature, and I'm going to talk about the same things, but I'm going to try to invent a language to talk about that. I'm going to try to invent words. That's also why sometimes I'm not, you know, comfortable with kind like of militant of activist vocable
umbrella term,
glossary or something, yeah. And to talk about the book, because it's like it's a different thing, you know. Yeah. I'm just trying to so it's just a different tool for the same kind of goal in life, you know. So but it's also very interesting, but I'm not, you know, I mean, it's cool if some people think it's militant, because I mean, it's political, but like blue is blue and green is green. Like, it's just it is because it is, you know. Mm. Because I talk from that part of the world, I guess, and it's very in the spotlight right now, but because they decided to, you know. That's also why I'm not explaining myself in the book. Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to make the character explain himself. I'm not claiming like the right to exist or something like that. I'm just, you know, just writing about our realities, what we are going through. Maybe if I was raised in a big castle, you know, with a white family, I would just write about that, you know. Maybe not. Maybe I would go in the, I don't know, in the suburbs and write about crap about, I don't know. What I was talking about, I don't remember.
Yes.
But that's just like that. But it's also why the book is so blurry, I will say, and foggy, and I'm just, I don't write to be understood. I just hope the reader gets lost in the book in a way. That's also because of that, because I don't want to be literal. I don't want to give lessons or to say, okay, this is what it is to grow up as a Arab man, or I don't know. Like, no, this is much more complex and subjective, you know, than that. And also, I mean, I have the right to write fiction, you know. I'm allowed to. That's a political act in that way. Maybe the book is in that way. Like, it's not a testimony. It's literature. Maybe this is the most political aspect of publishing How to Lead a Woman. You know, because we are always kind of waiting from women or Arab people, black people, like all of those oppressed communities that the only thing we are good for is sharing our experiences as, you know, very oppressed people. And that's not true. We are also creatives and we can bad fiction, you know?
Yeah. And about like the blurriness of the book, I remember that that is what attracted me to the French version in the first place, because I saw the book first. It's pink, it's my favorite color, so actually that was what attracted me to it, not gonna lie. But then I read the back cover and the title and I was like, I have no idea what this book is about actually. And it's just by reading that slowly you get the sense of what is happening, but it's really like distilled in the book in this very poetic way of writing that you have. And I was like, it's amazing to be able to access such stories in ways that are not always so direct, so marketed, so like, yeah, like this is my testimony, and branded, and yeah, to me, it's something like really, really powerful actually to be confronted to a text like that, that is in this subtlety of life and experience. It's not a question, sorry. Yeah.
Thank you. But that's what I said. I think my job is just to, you know, draw lines, I would say, but that can be interpreted as, you know, as you like. I mean, it's just like, it's not like, come with me, this is a story.
Yeah.
It's not go get lost. It's come with me, let's get lost. I mean, it's like, that's what I try to do. It's, so the more foggy it is, the more blurry it is, the more indecisive, imprecise. I mean, not imprecise, but you have to be very much precise, but like very, the more the reader can, you know, use his own imagination. And that's why also, no, I think of a difference between the UK and France, actually. Okay. they asked me about the background of the parents, for example. What's the job of the father?
Ah, okay.
You know, how does the mother look like? I mean, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but it is kind of true. I mean, they were much more interested, I think, in the sociological, you know, background.
Okay.
And that's something I did in purpose. I didn't want to describe physically the father or say, okay, today he's going to work and this is his job. And, you know, he's like this age and blah, blah, blah. Like, I wanted to be very much, just precise, because this is my way to escape through language. You know, this is my way to just be like trying to escape like those categories and those very rigid way of understanding people. That's also, I think, that's why the book is such, foggy or something like that.
Yeah.
the fog is actually like a character on itself, you know. I mean, on the first part of the book. And for more basic reasons, is just traveling in life and is becoming an adult, I would say. So it's just lost, and you go with him and you're trying to find a path.
Yeah, it's very true what you said, that about the like the blurriness and the fog being like its own character. And it's also something that is very beautiful in this book, is this, that I again don't know really how to formulate as a question, but this indecisiveness that is sometimes like a weight on the character's shoulder, like the like not being able to choose or not knowing how or not wanting to, and is sometimes more like a strength, like a point of view, like a decision, like not wanting but not as something.
But also because it, you know, it's torn between so many like injunction, I don't know, identities and communities. They are all waiting different things from him. They are all asking him to behave in different, very radically different ways. So he's just, at some point, he's just choosing fog. He's just choosing to be nothing, you know, to be in between. Like, this is, he's just to choosing to be an alien or something. Mm. And
I think this is all like, the questions I've heard.
They have questions.
There is someone who wants to ask a question.
You don't have to. Yeah, we can also have a drink. It's been a great night.
Okay, cool. Well then, thank you everyone. And
thank you,
Marwan.
Thanks for listening to the Ryle Books podcast. This episode was edited by Roz Del Olmo. You can find more of our past and upcoming events on our website, www.ryle.space.